We now have a paper by Michael Tripp, Helen Bradley, Russell Devitt, George Orris, Gregory Overton, Louise Pryor and Richard Shaw, called Quantifying Operational Risk in General Insurance Companies. And we have a bit of operational risk in practice because the laptop don't work. So I shall now ask Gregory, without use of laptop, to introduce the paper.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Does the audio work? I did a presentation a little while ago on operational risk where I actually simulated one of those blue screen computer breakdown failure situations. It went down very well, and everyone in the audience thought it was real. And I guess this is just things coming back to haunt me. We've now got the real thing. I wanted to say thank you, Mr. President, honoured guests, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Working Party, I'm delighted to share our paper with you this afternoon. I would like you to indulge me for a couple of minutes while I was going to show you, but talk to you about two pictures. Now, hopefully, if you've got a copy of the paper in front of you, both of the paper pictures will be in it. The first picture is on page 17 and represents the evolutionary scale of operational risk thinking from the traditional, which is really the not really worrying about operational risk too much at all and just assuming that it's implicit in everything else that the business does, to a fully integrated approach whereby operational risk feeds into capital and performance metrics. I was then going to have two nice big arrows that showed you that we think the insurance industry is spread broadly around the awareness phase, which is only the second rung of the set of steps, if you like. Operational risk is in its infancy as an area of debate and research for insurers. We believe the banks are further ahead than insurers. I would put those in the monitoring or quantification stages of that diagram. As a Gyro Working Party, we started off with a title, Measurement or Bust. But through our discussions, we realised that we needed to learn to walk before we could run, and we would certainly recommend that the area be progressed in the same steady manner going forwards. There's still quite a lot to do. This is a good point to highlight that our paper is work in progress, that the subject is wide and requires significant further thought and input from others, both within and certainly from experts outside the profession. We look forward to hearing some of your thoughts this afternoon. I'd like to mention the case study. Our first stumbling block in the paper was a lack of data, so we made it up. The case study is fictional. Any resemblance to a real company is entirely accidental. It's pragmatic in that the risk manager in the case study has to do something to come up with an operational risk approach. It's not cutting edge in that the risk manager does not have time to do everything. It's unrealistic. It's perhaps unlikely that any one company would have all of the issues of Mel G PLC. But it was the only option, and we would ask whether the industry should be doing more to collect data. Perhaps the most difficult area in terms of data is soft issues, and we hope that the section in the paper on soft issues has developed some useful ideas in that area. I know our president is very keen on the dominance risk and mentions it at every occasion. I look forward to another comment on that this evening. We certainly believe that incorporating these qualitative issues with quantitative methods is an area where actuaries should be able to help. One example is the risk maps in the paper that help break down and understand a process, which can then be converted into a Bayesian causal model for quantification. Causal modelling is, I believe, an area that sits particularly well with the cause and effect relationships that exist within operational risk, and is certainly an area that we believe should be investigated further. On that note, if you would like to turn to page 82 in the paper, Appendix D9, there are a number of spider maps, if you like. A number of people have asked us what on earth these are. I want to take a very short time to try and explain a little bit. There was, as some may noticed, one of those diagrams missing in the paper, another operational risk, unfortunately. We haven't caught it yet, but we hope to soon. The images displayed are from the Netica software, which we used for the Bayesian causal model. They illustrate the causal relationships, those are the arrows, between various variables, those being the boxes. The bottom box is labelled policyholder harm, and that is the output that we have discussed in the paper. And it can be seen as a probability distribution around three outcomes, one of which is a disaster scenario, which is the point that we quantified within a table in the paper. The probability distribution you see there is dependent on the previous boxes, market risk, reputational risk, what have you, which are in turn dependent on the previous boxes. And the distribution is calculated using Bayes' conditional probability. The boxes initially can be populated from judgment or expert opinion, giving a previous or prior belief of what the system looks like. But as observations are made and control systems altered, the model will recalculate the picture to refine your result. Now, I think I don't want to go into any more detail about those Bayesian causal models at the risk of sending everyone to sleep. I think I've spoken enough. We look forward to your observations on the paper, particularly areas perhaps that we haven't covered. What are people doing about operational risk now? What should the industry be doing? What contribution can the Institute make? How will operational risk modelling develop? Will measurements become widely accepted? Or will we have a situation that focuses on soft issues, that focuses on monitoring and controls? I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
James Orr to open the discussion. Yes.
I want to begin with a confession. This is the first sessional meeting I've ever been to. I was hoping I might be sitting in the audience at my first sessional meeting. So if I don't follow due form, I hope you'll forgive me. I've got to first say that, I think this is a brave paper. I think this is taking on a new area for actuaries. My interest in this area started off in 2001, where I chaired the original GIRA working party looking at operational risk. And I think what we ended up doing was really just scoping out the area, getting a feel for what was involved, starting to look at this problem of defining what operational risk actually is. And I think what Michael Tripp and the others have succeeded in doing is making something much more substantial and moving much further than our original paper had probably envisaged was possible. So I must congratulate him and the others on doing that. The paper itself starts off by talking about the kind of FSA impetus for this. The regulator says we must deal with operational risk. But it also has to be said during the paper, they flag up that the FSA's interest is very specific in terms of its personal objectives, in terms of market effectiveness, consumer protection, and the prevention of financial crime. So really, the FSA might be the stimulus for our interest in this area, but there's a much richer seam that we need to be looking to mine in terms of solving this operational risk issue. And if I can just say a few words about how I personally kind of view operational risk. I mean, operational risk is really saying, understand the entire business process, the way in which it creates value, understand all the intricacies and potential flaws. You can see all of the risks that a business is presented with. And I think the straight answer, or the straight conclusion one can draw, is that it's going to be extremely difficult. And I think that's reflected in the range of issues that this paper has had to cover. There's a comment made that insurers are lagging behind everybody else. And I think in some ways that's true. Certainly at first appearances it's true. But we need to think about, okay, what are the particular risks that others, say, in the banking world or project management world have been looking at, where they would say, yes, these people are at the leading edge, these people are ahead of us. And the specific risks they've been looking at perhaps have got certain qualities that are more manageable. A project sits within a box. Market risk is something where there's a, you know, rich data gets created naturally by the business processes. And I think in insurance, we have our own quite well-solved insurance risks that perhaps we should just say for a second, yes, we do understand these risks well. Underwriters every day are making decisions related to that risk. So I don't think we should be too hard on ourselves. The one picture that, one of the two pictures that Gregory referred us to, gives quite a simple high-level view of risk management maturity. And I know that Stephen Ward from Southampton University has been looking at this whole question of maturity of risk management systems, and he uses a six-dimensional approach to look at the whole issue of getting from just this basic awareness of risk and very closed pockets ad hoc view of how do we respond to risk, to this integrated, as he would call it, embedded approach towards risk and the whole question of culture, which again I was very glad to see the paper was not afraid to take on and did a very good job in scoping out that whole issue of the softer side of the kind of working of a business. If there was a quote that I'd pull out from there, is that the key issue is relationships. That we've got to look at the relationships between people. I think that brings in the key about dominant risk that Jeremy has referred to before. And we really need to think about, okay, the whole system and the people that make it run. I thought the illustrative example was very good that was used. I particularly like the group risk aspects of it, which is something that the FSA have flagged up to us, and I thought that was illustrated very nicely. And also the reliance upon a cause and consequence model. I think that helps us. It's a tool, it's a knife that lets us just cut open risk and say, okay, what is actually going on? What things do we need to know and what things do we need to understand in order that we can take on this challenge of managing risk better? And then there was a section on risk indicators, which flagged up the idea of exposure, loss and cause indicators. And I thought that was, again, very practical and useful set of prompts there that we could use. And then moving on to capital and stress and scenario testing and thinking about are there adequate resources at all times for the operation to run forward. Again, that was bringing it back to the CP190 part of things, what the FSA are asking us to look at. And then it went on to distribution issues and looking at extreme value theory, which the paper did a very good job of describing very quickly and succinctly. Bayesian belief networks, Gregory's already mentioned. That's another area that was of interest to me. I invited a researcher looking at Bayesian belief networks to come to GIRO, I think it would be about 3 years ago. And I think it was fair to say that there's a gap then, and I think there's still a gap now in terms of actuaries beginning to understand Bayesian belief networks, their strengths and also their weaknesses. But they do provide us with a good framework in which we can start to look at a problem, capture our beliefs and also start to feed in data that we can update and improve our estimated view of the potential outcomes. So I think the last few things I'd want to flag up is just from section 10, a couple of quotes. From the paper itself. Talking about what the challenge is ahead, it really just reinforces the points I've said before, that we require an insight into an understanding of process management, organisational design, including defining roles and responsibility, occupational psychology, a new thing for actuaries, and general management. I mean, there really is a broad challenge there. And I think it's one that the actuaries are actually well suited to. I don't think we should be afraid of getting involved in this area. And then the last thing to just quote is we believe that ultimately understanding operational risk should be driven by the desire for business success and value creation, coming back to my original comments, more so than the fear of failing FSA tests or even the risk of complete ruin, vital though these later two motivators should be. I mean, businesses are out there to create value, protect value, and I think that this refocusing or this focusing on operational risk is something that's timely and has the potential to add great value. Okay.
The paper discusses the example of a primary company. I'd like to add some comments from the point of view of a reinsurance company. First of all, on the size of operational losses. When I look back over the last 20 years at the experience of London market companies, I can see four key events that have dominated their profits performance. US asbestos and pollution, the LMX spiral, the UK storms of 1987 and 1990, and the US D&O and PR losses of the recent years, 1997 to 2001. Subjectively, I will characterise them as follows. US asbestos and pollution, those losses came from external changes, so I would allocate those to insurance risk. LMX spiral losses, I think we have to be frank and admit that those were entirely the company's own fault. So they failed to monitor aggregates properly, gross and net of reinsurance, so I'd allocate those 100% to operational risk. The cost of the UK windstorms was within controls, so I'd allocate them totally to insurance risk. And then when you look at the recent US casualty losses, they were triggered by external events, but the impact to insurers in the London market was greatly exaggerated by poor documentation and contract wordings. So I'd allocate those one-third to insurance risk and two-thirds to operational risk. So looking at that across the piece, then I'd say approximately one-third of reinsurance underwriting losses across the last 20 years could be said to arise from operational risk. And this is a topic that we're addressing very firmly in our company, the blurring between insurance risk and operational risk. We think that's a matter that needs much detailed treatment. CP 190 requires firms to identify, and I quote the words they use, the extent to which the capital needs for operational risk are not adequately covered by the ECR. So we'll need to model our underwriting risks separately between insurance and operational losses to avoid unnecessary double counting of capital requirements. We've got many techniques for modelling insurance risk, and there are very few for modelling operational risk. So I congratulate the working party for pushing ahead in this unexplored area. They've done us a great service. Another topic I'd like to mention is that of keeping a log of your large losses. Operational risk arises from the failure of systems and controls. So you could say that insurance and market risk, that's what's caused by chance events when management is doing a good job, but operational risk is what happens when management goes wrong. And in my view, it's very important for firms to adopt a culture of honest acceptance of previous mistakes. They should monitor all their large technical losses over the last 20 years. They should categorise them honestly between operational failure and genuinely fortuitous losses. And they should document these findings and educate aspiring young managers in the lessons to be learned. Because when you think about it, we write annual contracts, but our senior personnel turn over every 5 years, but we undertake risks with return periods of 25 years and longer. So it's absolutely vital to maintain a large loss log to help create what I call a corporate memory. This large loss concept is similar to the table in section 2.9 of the paper, except that for reinsurance companies, I think that operational losses from the failure of underwriting controls are likely to be the dominant ones in that list. And then finally on prioritisation. Our businesses are getting more complex by the day. We need to keep rebuilding our processes and systems all the time. And at the same time, reporting demands are increasing. More audits, more governance, more evidencing of systems and controls. And the only way for a firm to cope with all this without substantially increasing costs is to have a way of prioritising all these demands consistent with its measure of profitability. And I think that quantification of operational risks is a way to help you with this prioritisation. You need to structure the output of your operational risk calculations in such a way that you can see in some way the probabilities, impacts and capital requirements split by the separate activities and functions within your firm. Then when you get several competing demands for improvements and reporting requirements, you can compare their costs with the reduction in the risk that could arise. This idea is demonstrated by figure 9.12 in the paper, and I'd recommend it as a key output when you're designing the output from your operational risk activities. So in summary, I see many, many business benefits from quantifying operational risk well. You might be able to save on your firm's capital requirements. By helping management document properly the high costs of failed controls, you can reduce the cost of future unnecessary losses. And by prioritising business improvement projects, you can find the ones that produce the best relative return. So I'd urge actuaries to get involved in this topic. If you do it well, it will give you the opportunity to make many visible contributions to the better running of your companies.
Roger Jackson.
And then, firstly like to thank the Working Party for what I think is a very well-researched paper, which seems to leverage off some of the good work that's been done in other areas, such as the Basel Accord within the banking arena. I also particularly liked the case study, which enabled the reader to visualise what sort of the theory might look like in practice. I've got three main points I want to just raise. I think the first one is really about how we're bridging this gap from theory into actual practical reality as far as the insurance industry is concerned, in particular as far as trying to come up with actual numbers for operational risk, for example, for the ICA calculations that companies will be endeavouring to calculate this year and going forward. What I'd like to see going forward is some help in trying to or helping people in trying to see what actually some of these actual numbers might look like as far as capital is required. There are various methods for doing this, of course, one of them being, for example, proxy methods that we could rely on, but just a real steer in the right direction as far as what companies are probably getting to grips with, which is figuring out what the number should be. For the second of my points I'd like to raise is really around regarding data. In the paper, it does make reference to whether the data should be driven by the needs of the model, or whether the models should drive the availability of the data. I think what we need is obviously an approach that will work now, which means that we, I think, at the moment have to look at what data is available currently. And also at the same time, obviously, bearing in mind the theory as far as the other models are concerned, and therefore what data we should be starting to capture going forward in over the next three years, so that we can then make best use of the approaches going forward as well. One of these, of course, is causal modelling, which the paper goes into in great depth. And just an observation on the causal modelling side of things. It seems to, I think, come from the FSA's occasional paper 20, which goes into causal modelling and looking at, based on the insurer's actually probability of ruin, rather than day-to-day operational risk management. So one thing I would suggest is that we bear in mind that that's where some of this work came from, and take that into consideration when thinking about whether to apply this in practice for general operational risk uses going forward. Again, I'd like to thank the Working Party for a very interesting paper and instructive paper. Thank you.
Mohammed Khan. And then Louise Pryor.
It's sad to note that the insurance industry appears to be behind other financial services organisations when it comes to understanding operational risk in their own businesses. Insurance, at its most basic level, after all, is the quantification of risk. My belief is that we should be one of the professions leading the thinking on risk. The paper is very timely in that regard and is an excellent introduction to the quantification methods currently possible for operational risk. I've just got a few small observations. I think the key test for insurance companies will actually be to cascade their appetite for risk through their organisations. The authors do briefly touch on this, and our role models, I think, should be some of the banks where risk quantification actually plays a significant part in making any business decision. James Orr briefly mentioned whether he thought insurance companies were behind banks. In terms of culture, I do wonder whether all staff in insurance companies are aware of what their company's appetite for risk is, and whether they actually consider this when they're making any type of business decision that may affect their company. The paper discusses various methods to quantify operational risk and does list some further areas for research. I would like to add one more. How does a quantification of insurance and operational risk fit into the kind of overall quantification or understanding of enterprise-wide risk? For example, does diversification of risk reduce capital for strategic, insurance, operational risk, all three? If it does reduce it for all three, how much should we allow for the kind of cross-line of risk reduction? The authors commendably list a plethora of potential models, both for hard and for soft modelling, that can be used to quantify operational risk. Some of us may think, which is the best model, which is the better model, which should we use for certain situations? My personal thought is that, as with all models, and the authors themselves state this, it's not actually the model itself which is of value, but the thinking behind the assumptions and the interpretation of the results of the model, which are of greater value. This kind of comes back to the culture point. If a company is actively thinking about the types of risks that it's taking and the risk appetite and its own risk appetite, it's far more likely to mitigate operational risk than another company that doesn't think about these things, but every year annually uses a highly sophisticated model to come up with its capital requirement for its operational risk. In section 3.11, the authors mention the use of self-assessment indicators. They use the example of determining availability of management information and complexity of reinsurance arrangements. These types of indicators are very useful because you basically get people to sort of fill in their thoughts on whether, for example, that they get enough management information or whether they believe enough management information is being passed upstairs. The problem with these kinds of indicators is that it can usually be disrupted simply by the morale of the staff on the day that they fill in the indicators. If they got out of the wrong side of bed, basically they're going to slag off anyone that they can get their hands on. So I'm wondering whether the use of iterative Delphi methods may be more appropriate in these situations. Although it's more time-consuming and it's more costly, it may be less susceptible to the mood of the staff on a particular day. In section 5.5.14, sorry to get so detailed, the authors discuss the use of a management consultancy to assess the potential exposure of the example company to very large losses and to losses of types not yet reflected in the internal data. Andrew Hitchcock earlier referred to creating a large loss database for each company. I was wondering whether the insurance industry should consider doing that themselves, akin to something I believe that the British Bankers Association are doing with their gold database. Although it would take time to populate the database, it would give the insurance industry something to benchmark some of its operational risks against and would help companies to, as it were, share all of the large but very sparse data that they will have on these types of risks. To conclude, I commend the authors on an excellent paper. It was very easy to read, and would reiterate their call at the end of the paper. This is an area where I think actuaries can contribute. Yes, it is something that we don't know much about, and so it is a risky area for us to enter. But then, isn't risk where we work? Thank you.
Louise Pryor, then Richard Beryl.
I just want to point up some of the things we said in the paper that have been made especially relevant by recent current events. Firstly, in section 8 of the paper, we discuss what we called soft issues and highlight the importance of the ability to admit mistakes. Now, I'm not going to talk about dominance risk, and I'm not going to talk about the insurance industry here. I'm going to talk about banking. The National Australia Bank lost $360 million recently, admittedly Australian dollars, but $360 million is still quite a lot of them, through rogue currency traders. There were failures in systems and controls, but the report that PwC prepared for them pinpoints the main problem as having been the corporate culture. Apparently, there was a culture of arrogance at the bank. Bad news was filtered out of reports before they arrived at top management. Warnings from regulators and competitors met with an aggressive response. As a result, the four dealers concerned and their immediate manager, who the current CEO, the last CEO, lost his job a few months ago when this whole thing first came to light, the current CEO said that their immediate manager had been asleep at the wheel. Three more senior people, including the head of risk, also lost their jobs. They weren't directly involved, but the CEO said it happened on their watch. This is a warning to us all. If you're involved in risk management and things go horribly wrong, it's your fault. This is obviously an extreme case, and not all problems in corporate culture lead to losses in the hundreds of millions. But it seems to me that the usual pattern is probably followed, and that there are many more smaller losses that we never hear about, whose cumulative effect is probably much greater. So at all levels, corporate culture matters on this. The second point I want to make is the double counting point. We mentioned this briefly in section 3.7.2. Where we say that the effects of poor claims handling processes are already implicitly included in the loss reserves. In other words, some operational losses are already being modelled, albeit as insurance losses. This problem of double counting is more widespread than this single example suggests, and is something that anyone trying to quantify operational risk should be aware of. It's obviously important that issues such as claims handling processes aren't ignored when considering operational risk, but equally important that they aren't included in the models twice over. It's perfectly possible to include some issues in operational risk when you're looking at controls and mitigation, but not to model them explicitly if they are already being modeled implicitly elsewhere. That this is a widespread problem was brought home to me recently by a discussion on an electronic mailing list that I receive. Now, again, this list is mostly bankers, and someone flagged up the problem of a book of loans had had a bad experience because of poor processes in their credit department, and that this was being modelled as a credit loss, essentially as part of credit risk, whereas in fact it was probably operational risk. I was somewhat surprised to see that this concept of possible double counting was a new one to a number of people on the list. So maybe the bankers aren't always a long way ahead of us. But anyway, this prompted me to try to come up with a list of other areas in which double counting could occur. I failed. Not because I couldn't think of any, but because every area I thought of appeared to fit the bill. Which brings me to my final point. We've been discussing, and presumably I think we'll continue to discuss, how actuaries can play a role in managing and especially quantifying operational risk. However, we can also be a source of risk. Risk models are typically complex computer models like the ones actuaries already use for pricing and reserving. And indeed, one of the points we try to bring out in the paper is how the techniques that we already use to model insurance losses can also be used to model operational losses. Inadequate systems and controls surrounding the development of these models and the derivation of the data and assumptions that feed into them will inevitably lead to unreliable results. Although it is certainly true that a great deal of the value of models is in the thinking they provoke, sometimes one just has to use the results and treat them as numbers, and in that case, you need to have confidence in them. As we move to modelling more and more aspects of insurance companies, we should strive to ensure that our models are as reliable and trustworthy as we can make them. Don't just believe the numbers because they come out of the computer. make sure that you develop your models using appropriate methodologies and systems and controls. We don't want to introduce any extra operational risk. Thank you.
This is a joint contribution with my colleague from Cass Business School, Robert Cowell. Operational risk is a field in its infancy, and clearly we can expect many modelling approaches to be developed in addition to the ones covered by the authors. We welcome the discussion of the authors of the use of Bayesian networks. We have been looking at applying Bayesian networks to operational risk, and our work is described in a recent research report, Modelling Operational Risks with Bayesian Networks, which is available through the Cass Business School website. The aim of this paper and of our comment here is to bring to the attention of actuaries simple methods about which they may be unaware that have been developed for assessing and updating Bayesian networks in the light of data. The paper, the research paper, goes into detail about how the probabilities specified in a Bayesian network may be updated with data, a topic which is touched on by the authors of this paper. It also gives details about quantitative methods of assessing in real time, i.e. as the data come in, the predictive performance of Bayesian networks. For those of people whose appetite has been whetted by this paper and the subject of Bayesian nets, we'd like to mention two other sources of information that might be useful. One is the book Probabilistic Networks and Expert Systems by Robert Cowell, Phil David, Stefan Lorentzen and Dave Spiegelhalter. And the other one is a freely available piece of software called XBayes, which is also available from the Cass Business School website through Robert Cowell's webpage. We believe that Bayesian networks have very great potential in the area of operational risk, and we look forward to more developments in this field. Thank you.
Having been inspired by those contributions, could I have now a show of hands of those who would like to speak?
My name is Silas Malde, President, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I'd like to express my thanks to the authors for the wide-ranging coverage of operational risk, looking at it both from a theoretical and practical viewpoint. And I'd really just like to make two small points. First of all, I think although as actuaries we can help in developing sophisticated techniques and models, I strongly advocate that we start off being pragmatic and use a pragmatic approach to the evaluation of operational risk. If we go too far down the theoretical route, we may switch off some of our fellow risk professionals. Secondly, there's a quote near the end of the paper saying the number which comes out from the work that has been done in terms of what operational risk accounts for in terms of the total capital that you might need, and the figure quoted is 2% of net written premium, which probably equates to, say, 5% of the total capital. For me, I think what gets classified as operational risk, first of all, will depend on a number of organization-specific features, like the structure of the company, what the people's roles are, what the reporting lines are, what the governance is. Secondly, it will also depend on the history of the company. And thirdly, possibly on the data that they've got. And when you combine this with the different businesses written by different companies, the processes which are different, the systems which are different, the people who may be different in terms of the way they interact. I think the capital charge for operational risk can vary significantly between organizations. And I think it could easily range from 1% to perhaps 50% of the total capital requirements. So I think when the FSA comes to look at this, you've got to be a little bit careful. I think there was someone who was saying it would be useful to have some guidance on what this amount should be. I think we just need to be a little bit careful. And perhaps I can just finish with another quote from Mahatma Gandhi. Honest differences are often a healthy sign of progress.
Good evening. My name is Gil Heathcote. I also enjoyed the case study part of the paper, but one concept which was only touched on indirectly in the paper is what one might term the gross versus the net risk. Managing operational areas all have risk management as an implicit part of their role. If you ask them what the risks are in their area, they'll likely tell you about the net risks, those that they perceive remain after taking into account the mitigation that they've built into the processes. Unless you ask the right question, which is, what could go wrong if we didn't manage it properly, you won't find the gross risk. Thank you.
I only caught two hands go up last time. So we've got, yes.
Thank you, Mr. President. Firstly, a couple of points. I was rather surprised in paragraph 7512 to see that operational losses were assumed not to be correlated with other losses, because it's precisely when you get other losses that you get massive operational losses. And there was, in fact, the example gave a very good one, which was the reinsurance contract. If there hadn't been losses impacting the insurance contract, there wouldn't have been any operational loss. Secondly, the ruin percentages coming out in the table, well, it's a worthwhile exercise to do it, but one should be extremely sceptical, and particularly in an analysis like this, which deliberately left out some of the risks. And finally, paragraph 10.4, which I would endorse, but if your only motivation is fear of failing FSA tests, you will fail the FSA tests because it won't be embedded in the organisation.
Put a hand up, promised, at the back. Left. Sorry. Yes, I beg your pardon.
My name is Alistair Christmas. I work in the Operational Risk Consultancy Division of HSBC. I'm also studying for a master's degree in insurance and risk management at the Cass Business School. Prior to joining HSBC earlier this year, I was the chief risk officer for Rothschild Asset Management. That was a position I held for 6 years. I just really want to make sort of several sort of points and observations from this evening. And I'll be brief. And I think the point about arrogance and aggression is a very good one. Because if anyone is arrogant or aggressive to me as a risk officer, it's a very good sign that they're trying to hide something. The definition of operational risk, there are lots of them, but there's something that I always used to sort of go along with, was operational risk is about the preservation of profits, and it's about the prevention of losses. And one of the questions I kept on asking people particularly when we were doing risk mapping and self-assessment, was a simple question to senior people within any organisation, is what keeps you awake at night? There's a great, I think, something else which is missed on operational risk. An operational risk is about common sense. And as a risk officer, it is about understanding of the business. Now, another thought I would share with you as to how you get buy-in from a board of directors or your chief executive. One way I found, which was quite effective, is basically to frighten the living daylights out of people. And I say that because if you look at the if you look at what is coming out of the Financial Services Authority, but particularly at, say, about Sarbanes-Oxley, which basically says is that any US-listed company has to do a self-assessment process once every 3 months. The maximum penalty is that either the chairman or the chief executive or both can go to jail for 20 years if they don't have their operational risk systems up to the required standards under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. I read the paper with extreme interest, but I also think one should be very carefully considering the whole aspects of risk mapping, self-assessment, key risk indicators, and key performance indicators. I also think that you should carefully consider the balance between the quantitative approach to operational risk, but also to be balanced with the qualitative approach to operational risk. And basically what I say to people is quite simple, and it is simple. Operational risk is about common sense. It's also about keeping matters simple, because if you keep it simple, people will actually understand your message. And at the end of the day, it's something that I have found that worked, and I'll leave those thoughts with you.
There's a gentleman on the balcony who'd like to say something. Are you going to shout and see how you get on?
Very good. My name is Julian Lee, and I do thank the authors for this paper, which I found most interesting and thoughtful. I did show it to my colleagues who are operational risk experts rather than actuaries. Neither will be here tonight for personal reasons, but their reaction was interesting. One was, not too politely, that this is a typical actuarial paper in that it's thoroughly numeric. He pointed out that, for example, CP190 encourages us to manage risk, to manage and avoid operational risk, just as much as to quantify it. Now, this seemed to me to be quite an impressive criticism, and I thought about it a bit longer. And certainly it is true that CP190 encourages these things. It also requires us to come out of the end with an ICA that actually quantifies the capital required for operational risk. So I think on balance we must welcome the attempt to go well beyond the qualitative approach. In particular, I find the bubble plots at the end very useful, not so much in the absolute numbers that each of them shows, but in the fact that moving from one to another, one sees the precise effect of the litigation procedures. However, we should be aware, as actuaries, that there are specialists out there who can help us greatly with our approach to operational risks. I sometimes think that it is one of our faults that when we do look to extend our professional work to wider fields, we sometimes fail to notice that some of these fields are not rather past, but in fact have been plowed by others before us. And while we may be able to add our own particular approach to this, we shouldn't ignore what's gone before. I recently took part in a brainstorming session on a new company to try and identify its operational risks. This is an example of a sort of soft approach, a non-quantitative approach, and it was a very useful exercise. I have to say, however, that we took 2 hours to do it, and we could well have gone on all day. And there is a necessity not only to identify the risks, but also to identify which of them are important, which of them need development.
and which of them should be rectified. That I feel is to bring it back from the qualitative into the quantitative approach. Indeed, I feel in some ways that to have identified an operational risk is to have taken the first step to rectifying it, and it's the ones that we haven't identified in that way that we should have to be most concerned about. Finally, I'd like to make a comment about the remarks in the paper, because they are on professional guidance. I feel this is something where the profession ought to be treading carefully. At the moment, we are experimenting with different procedures and different ways to meet the answer. And I feel that anything that's too prescriptive could be damaging to the development of our practice in this area. Also, I think it's likely to be an area where, if we are assisting our clients and employers, that we are likely to be doing so for a long time, and perhaps permanently, in close cooperation with other professionals, and we should make sure that any guidance that is given by the profession takes that into account and shouldn't assume that it's actuaries from beginning to end.
Thank you. Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. President. Dave Finnish is my name. I thought I might share with you all a couple of my perspectives. The first one from Australia, where I spend most of my time these days, thankfully, given the weather around here the last few days. The approach to operational risk over there was changed somewhat by regulatory reform we had about 2 years ago now, where our regulator introduced a new standard on risk management. After a lot of debate, they went along the lines of, if I can use an analogy with the Basel Committee work for banks, or the Basel Committee, as we tend to call it in Australia, with Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, which I'm sure most of you are aware of. We went along the Pillar 2 approach for operational risk. The argument there was that I think a lot of the problems in measuring operational risk when you're trying to quantify it, you tend to focus on the sort of high-frequency, low-severity operational risk, perhaps at the expense of the low-frequency, high-severity risks that obviously the ones that we tend to really, really concern us. So we've moved along that Pillar 2 approach, but interestingly what it's tended to do is introduce a series of opportunities for actuaries to model operational risks almost on an iterative improvement approach. So we're tending to start to quantify areas that perhaps we wouldn't have done in the past. My second perspective is from the point of view of the Working Party on Solvency from the International Actuarial Association. We had on that Working Party quite a long debate about whether operational risk should go under the Pillar 1 or Pillar 2 approach. In the end, we plumped for Pillar 1. And again, the thinking there was that given we were looking at the future philosophy rather than the current position, the future philosophy was very much that we wanted to quantify risk in a way such as this paper, which I have to say, had this paper been around, we would have definitely used it, I think, as part of that committee. So I would add my thanks to the authors for the paper. Thank you.
Evening. Kevin Tidman, RBS Insurance, previously with Lloyds GSB, where I spent a number of years looking at the Basel proposals for operational risk. I really just want to pass on a number of observations which hopefully will help in the evolution of this paper. Something that I didn't detect in there was around validation, how the business themselves will validate any model, and equally important, how the FSA will validate your model. It was an issue of hot debate with the FSA from the banking perspective, and I haven't heard that it's been resolved yet. And I'm sure it would be of equal importance in modelling for insurance operational risk. In terms of the number, when you set about developing a model, I think it's important that you have a discussion internally and understand exactly what you're trying to get out of the number. Is it a number to satisfy the regulators? Is it a number to satisfy you in terms of driving behaviour in your business? Is it a combination of the two? Or is there another factor in addition? I think you need to have those debates internally before you start going too far down developing the model. There are a number of banks that have actually gone as far as developing a model which calculates capital, an economic capital figure, by which they drive behaviour in the business. However, when you drill down into the use of that number, a number of banks that have used it are quite comfortable that as a behavioural tool, it drives behaviour from the MDs of the businesses down through the organisation. When you press them in terms of do they believe it's the right number from a capital perspective, there is less confidence. I think the last point I want to make is around data. In my previous role, I was involved in the BPA Gold database, and it was a very good database, and it was a very good example of how otherwise competitive bodies would freely share information. And often it was somewhat embarrassing, particularly if you happen to hold the pole position of having the largest loss in the database. And that did change hands from bank to bank over the last few years. But nevertheless, it does demonstrate there is a willingness to share data. Whether or not the insurance industry has got that same willingness, we'll wait and see, I guess. But if you are going to go down that route, it is very important that you have a very clear understanding and definition of what you're reporting. And that's particularly important when you talk around these boundary issues. What's an insurance risk? What's an operational risk? The same debate has been taking up a lot of time within the banking industry between what's a credit loss and what's an operational loss. And I've yet to find two bankers that will agree on any common set of definitions, and I would suspect the same will happen in the insurance industry. But you won't know until you start having that debate, and certainly if you're going to start sharing data, you do need to go through that exercise. I think last thing in summary, I think the actual actuarial profession has a golden opportunity here. You have the skill sets to come up with the answer that has so far eluded both the bankers and the regulators. So I hope you take the most of an opportunity here, because we're all waiting for the answer.
It's Peter Gatenby. First, I'd just like to say, thank the authors, as many of the rest of us have done. This was, to me, one of the most readable and interesting papers that I've read over the years. And on top of that, it's also very useful, and very useful in the current environment. It's written and advertised as a general insurance paper, but in fact, it isn't a general insurance paper. It's the issues and the techniques covered in the paper are equally applicable across the life industry, pensions, and other disciplines. And I think it's probably a shame that a lot of our actuarial colleagues in life companies and some of our pension actuary colleagues have probably not even bothered to read the paper because it had the words general insurance on the front. So I really like certainly anybody here tonight from those other disciplines or with colleagues in those other disciplines, I commend them to read the paper, because I'm sure that everybody will find it useful. And possibly, I don't know if there's an article going in the Actuary about the paper. If there is, it should it would be really useful if it isn't written as a general insurance article, if it's written as an actuarial wide article. The final point I'd like to make is it's also a pity that the lot of this work on operational risk has been led by the regulators and a regulatory need to measure and value operational risk. And I think there's an opportunity for actuaries to get involved with other risk experts in the whole risk consulting environment, to convince boards and directors and managements of companies, both in life insurers and general insurers, that using these techniques leads to better management of the business. It's not just because the regulators asking us to do it. So again, I think there's an opportunity for us to liaise with other experts to advance this and make it the foundation of good business practice, not just because the regulators are asking us to do it.
Who's next? You're not going to sit here for half an hour because they haven't opened the bottles yet. Any more? Am I missing anybody? Anyone in the council chamber? No? You sure? Okay. Then I'll ask Martin White to close the discussion. You've got half an hour.
Thank you. I was relying on 10 minutes in dominance risk, and it didn't happen. I won't take half an hour. This paper is packed with information and detail, much of it on issues that are outside the current actuarial mainstream. The paper and the discussion today remind me of a debate I attended here at the Institute some years ago, and the motion at that meeting was, an actuary who is only an actuary is not an actuary. At least one of the speakers is here tonight. I translate that in the context of this paper as follows. You can't get a reasonable grasp on operational risk, let alone advise on appropriate financial provision for it, unless you develop a sufficiently good understanding of the business processes and drivers, many of which would have previously escaped your attention. This requires an inquiring mind and involves working with all areas of the business, or at least gaining that understanding through the expertise of others. This is something James Orr referred to when opening the discussion. In general insurance, actuarial work tends to have very little ivory tower content. Instead, we spend much of our time on the people and business processes that make the decisions and generate the data. Our role is much more team member than sole expert. Here, tasked with helping a company assess the financial consequences of operational risk, we claim no unique expertise in the subject matter, but should be able to play a major part in its assessment. The paper demonstrates that we can contribute in this area. I think the working party have achieved something else. They have produced a paper for which the potential readership is not limited to actuaries, something which our non-actuarial colleagues may find useful. Julian Lee referred to the effort needed to identify risks. The critical skill that the team charged with monitoring, evaluating, and ultimately managing operational risk must have is the ability to ask the right questions. And we've heard from a risk officer with experience in the financial area on this subject. The paper mentions a number of ways of classifying risks, and some speakers mentioned the difficulty of getting consensus. The important thing would appear to be that a company adopts just one set of definitions and then sticks to it. Otherwise, there will be misunderstandings and time wasted in consequence. However, it's clear that you can't approach operational risk with too narrow a focus, shutting your mind to other types of risk. If real business benefit is to come out of the exercise, it will inevitably become part of the overall management of the business, and those charged with monitoring and managing operational risk will be part of the senior management team. It's essential to have an interest in what drives the success and failure of the entire business, a commercial focus, in other words. Going through the process of identifying risks, causes, and consequences highlights how much can and does go wrong in a business. And you can't escape the conclusion sometimes that the place to start may be right at the top with the ethos, motivation, risk, and reward structures of the directors themselves. Section 8 on soft issues begins to tackle this problem. Saying the unsayable is mentioned in the paper. It's not comfortable to be either the giver or receiver of such a message, which is why it doesn't always happen. A number of speakers congratulated the authors for making up the data and for giving us a case study. A company with a name which is clearly a marketing man's dream, Melge. There is a great deal of information here. Whilst Melge is made up in that the full catalogue of woes has been visited on one company, the adverse events themselves are all entirely plausible. On the subject of modelling, Louise Pryor warned us of the danger of believing our models, unless there has been a great deal of careful thought. Kevin Tippen referred to the difficulty of validating models. Shailesh Maldi urged us to err on the side of pragmatism rather than theory. And Peter Hinton reminded us that sometimes when things go wrong, they really go wrong in operational areas and other areas at the same time. And there is always a danger of our understanding how bad a loss scenario can be. Soft issues rightly generated a lot of discussion. Andrew Hitchcock's talked about the need for a culture of honesty to admit past mistakes and to admit which losses are really operational rather than bad luck. Culture is clearly a major issue. I feel that an essential ingredient to the right culture is that senior management and the board have personal capital at stake in the business, not just share options. Mohammed Khan reminded us that we may not know what our company's appetite for risk really is, and the company may not know either. A number of speakers involved in risk management have shared experiences with us today. This area is evidently very resource hungry, not something you can dabble in, and management thinking time is always in short supply. Gil Heathcote reminded us about gross versus net risk and the need to ask the right question, which is, what could go wrong if we weren't already managing it properly? Now, on corporate governance and other external trends, as the President said when he took office, we live in changing times. In the UK, there has been a great deal of interest in all aspects of corporate governance, and this is not going to go away. Shareholders, particularly institutional shareholders, are being urged to be more demanding in holding boards to account. In the future, companies will have to include an operating and financial review, or OFR, in their annual report. The company law review recommended that the objective of the OFR should be as follows. To provide a discussion and analysis of the business and the main trends and factors underlying the results and financial position and likely to affect performance in the future, so as to enable users to assess the strategies adopted by the business and the potential for successfully achieving them. The OFR goes wider than operational risk, but it does include it. So the kind of thinking contained within today's paper will be needed for far more than just solvency regulation. As the paper suggests, it should be embraced just as much for the business benefits it delivers as for the fact that the regulators have instructed us to do it. This is a new field for us, which has been sparked in the main by the UK regulators. It's not often the industry admits the regulators have done them a favour, but I think that the FSA's new demands that companies identify, attempt to quantify, and then manage their risks must come pretty close. None of this is easy, and operational risk is perhaps the aspect which has had least attention to date. Now, time and effort is worth a mention. Our authors have been working on this project for a number of years, and a huge effort has gone into it, and we do owe them a debt. They should be congratulated for daring to go outside the safe zones of most current actuarial activity and for producing something that companies should find has real practical value. Thank you.
Michael Tripp to respond to the debate.
Thank you, Mr. President. Perhaps I should start with an apology. I think an apology for not being controversial enough. I have to say that I stand here on behalf of the team, and I'll say thank you to the team in a moment. Thinking, well, I agree with everything that's been said. I really genuinely can't think of anything that's been said tonight that I'd like to take issue with. Now, I know I'm a nice person, therefore I don't take issue with many people, but it's been a very sort of supportive of the fact that we're taking a first step for the profession in talking about these things publicly, evening, I think. And maybe that's what tonight is about. Maybe tonight is a step forward. I don't think any of the group that have been involved in this paper see it as that we've gone all the way there by any means. We think it is a path that is very important for us to take steps and numbers of steps forward. And perhaps tonight is a relatively uncontroversial first step, one for which we're grateful for so many people being here, and we really appreciate that. There will be more steps to come, so perhaps, Mr. President, having not been controversial enough in generating tremendous debate tonight, we hope we have sown the seeds for other people, maybe ourselves and others, to take further steps forward. There have been one or two missed areas that have come out, and I'm sure we'll take due notice of that. Just a couple of thoughts. I certainly agree with that this is not just general insurance. Yes, we had the word general insurance in the paper, that was where we started from, but pretty well I would like to think everything in the paper applies to any business that Actuary is involved in, and others for that matter. So for heaven's sake, if we are starting other working groups, and I know Nick Dexter's involved in one on the life side, let's build, let's work together, let's go across the boundaries, let's not stay in our business camps. So there's a sort of a plea there. Maybe, Mr. President, we ought to be thinking about some sort of, I don't know, I hate words like subcommittees or forums or whatever, but some sort of way of bringing it all together on behalf of the Institute so that we can all work together. And there are numbers of things that I think we could usefully do for the industry that we're involved in. I certainly would echo that it's not just about actuaries. The working party itself is not just actuaries, hasn't been just actuaries, and it's really encouraging to see all sorts of people here, and I hope that the non-actuaries have found us quite human. maybe you haven't, I don't know. but I think there is a role for quantification, just as there is a very important need to realise that qualitative analysis is as important as quantitative analysis. So I'd like to think that actuaries can make a contribution, should make a contribution, but can do so in a way which is collaborative with all sorts of other expertises. I'm not necessarily suggesting that we need to get occupational psychology onto the actuarial syllabus, but at least there should be some sort of understanding about how these things come together. And I've sometimes talked about we need not just to quantify things for capital management, but sometimes we need to think about maybe there should be ways of assessing the corporate environment. You know, maybe it is like a rating thing that credit rating agencies use, maybe it's not, but something which gets onto the agenda that things, the soft issues, are capable of influencing. I know people have talked to me about not quantifying operational risk. You can't quantify it because actually the whole thing changes. The moment you talk about operational risk, then actually all the past statistics are irrelevant because the future just won't mirror them. I'm not personally convinced by that argument. I do think quantification has its place, as does all the models we've been talking about have their place, but it is their place, and it's not sort of the be-all and end-all. It's a contribution to the understanding, and it's about understanding systems and controls and so on, that they're just as important. So just to flag that. I'm sorry if we didn't necessarily appear to have recognised some of the Bayesian networking work that has been done, and obviously we didn't mean to offend anybody, but that's obviously a helpful contribution and something that we should perhaps bring to the fore in many people's minds. It is difficult to know what to say, because I think there is so much coming together in this. I do think the Institute has a role to play in some form of industry forum, and I would like to see us doing more than just having a paper and going away and doing our individual things. I'd like to see the Institute actually taking the lead to help the insurance industry, the life insurance, the general insurance, the pensions industries that we're all involved in, because I don't think we're that far behind the banking world. I think it's just that we've got different semantics and different ways of looking at these things. Back to the point about implicit versus explicit modelling of operational risk, I think the banking world has come at it from a different way to the insurance world. The insurance world has come at it from a different way to the banking world, and we can learn from each other. But we need to take a lead, I think, and the Institute is well placed to take a lead and make a real contribution to help the British insurance industry and the worldwide insurance industry, for that matter, grow and develop and prosper and be stronger for the future. So I'd like to think that will happen. If I'm not careful, I will rabbit on and lose my way. But there are two things I would like to say. No, there aren't the three things I would like to say. firstly is to Kevin Tidman, said it's a golden opportunity for actuaries to, I'm not quite sure, I'm putting words in your mouth, Kevin, to come up with an answer. I hope we can help, but every golden opportunity, there must be a golden black hole somewhere there as well. So I hope we don't fall down the golden black hole, but I hope we do make the best use of our skills to help everybody get a better understanding. The second thing I'd like to do is just to say, Mr. President, I know you're going to do a vote of thanks, but I would like to say a personal thank you to the members of the Working Party. They put up with me for the last few months, but I've actually really enjoyed it, and this has been a really, I'd like to say on behalf of this group, that it has been a true team effort. None of us can claim that the paper is us. It's a collection of all of us, and I hope it's been a useful collection for the profession. But I'd just like to say thank you to the members of the Working Party myself, because they've been very good to me. And the last thing I'd like to say is, I mean, we set out to provide a practical framework. There were some clues based on a case study. The case study does have its roots in reality. We're not allowed to say too much about that. I would just like to say to everybody, please, 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 looking to the future, don't let the subject drop. Do, Mr. President, let the Institute carry on the steps down the path we've taken and get to the end of that path, because there's a lot more we can do, and we're looking forward to it. So on behalf of the authors, thank you very much for a very warm reception.
It remains for me to add a few words of my own, and we certainly should take up Michael's challenge to keep the momentum going on this. And I think you have it in your own paper in 1013, the terms for future work. And maybe what we might do is ask you to... No, I didn't say that. but somebody who'd like to pick up the ball should perhaps just try and scope these out a little bit more to see what the sort of workflows might be from these. And I would seriously suggest that we do this together with Brendan Young and the Operational Risk Research Forum. Brendan's here. Yes, Brendan? No. That's yes, you will. but if we could work together with you, I think that would be good. So let's think about that. And again, unless Brendan Young wants to comment on the humanity of the actuaries that he's met tonight... there was obviously madness too in, or method in the madness of having general insurance in the title, because I'm quite sure that this is going to come back as operational risk in life insurance and then operational risk in pensions insurance, and you get three bites of the cherry, so it'll be exactly the same paper. You shouldn't be disappointed at the length of the discussion. These are always inversely correlated to the quality of the paper. So. And indeed, I think the contributions that we did have were wide-ranging, general, and helpful to us in the profession, with some serious practical stuff in there, and I look forward to rereading those when it's printed. One piece of operational risk I did come across is that presidents can't read the small print in Bayesian networks, so I had a little trouble with the tables, but I'll get my magnifying glass out and I'll get back. One thing I've thought of in the past, when I see Salesforce runs, when the salesman comes back and he rings the bell because he's made a sale, you'll have a board of the name of the salesman and the volume of production and so on the board. It's important stuff. And I've always thought that boardrooms should have a risk board along the sidewall with the name of the risk, the current amount of quantification, who's responsible for it, I bring it on and take it off, and keeping risk really visually in front of boards in that way and tracing them in a visual manner. It is by far the single most important feature that boards should be paying attention to, and I think they should run a visual risk board in their boardrooms. On bankers not agreeing on risk classification, well, those who are just finding that out have got the first qualification to be an actuary, so they all disagree with each other on it. So we could encourage them on the way there. So just let me finish off with a few words on dominance risk. This is something you've all been looking forward to. And I just want to make sure we understand that there's a difference between dominators and true entrepreneurs. And since raising this 18 months ago, I've been asked, almost everybody I meet, I say, tell me what the characteristic difference is between a dominator and an entrepreneur. Because entrepreneurs can be assertive, not very nice people perhaps, difficult to get on with, but they do create employment, big companies and successful results for shareholders. So what's the difference? And the differences I've come up with, first and foremost, dominators don't respect their systems and controls. They regard them as a pain and something to be got round rather than something to help them control the business. Dominators typically will not have their own money or shares in the company. The true entrepreneur will tend to have his own money or her own money in the company. And this dominance risk, and we've seen sufficient examples now in financial services, it's an opportunity not so much to measure, because you either see it or you don't. In fact, this is something you measure on the hairs of the back of your head, not so much in your spreadsheet. You really know, or in your dreams. I think we had a comment tonight. But it's an opportunity for an individual who has the guts to make a difference, to spot the early signs of dominance risk. And I'm not saying go through a formal whistleblowing process, but to use a process which we kicked off, and we may not have noticed, about 9 months ago, a process for conflict resolution. It was in an article in the Actuary about 9 months ago. And briefly, the process is, as in any conflict within work, is to raise the issue with the individual raising the conflict. Now, in the terms of dominance, you know you're going to get short shrift, but it's where you really should start, or with someone in between them and you. If that doesn't work, go and talk to a senior member of your firm or of the profession and say, look, I see something like this, what do you see? And see if you can't get some help, again, to help solve the issue yourself in your workplace. If that doesn't work, then the specific place to go in the profession is the Professional Guidance Committee. And Michael Scott is there to receive phone calls to say, look, there's something that is troubling me in my organisation, and I need to talk it over with someone and talk it over with a profession to find out what I should do about it. And we can provide certainly, and there's confidentiality is obviously a big issue. We have to define what the confidentiality status is when we start. But we can usually find, and have found, little networks or other networks within Actuary Land that can bring appropriate pressure to bear to relieve the problem. Now, the particular issues I came across myself, and this is several years ago now, was a very dominant attitude towards the level of maintenance costs in life companies. And that typical statement from the CEO was, I will put in a cost reduction program next year so that in 3 years' time maintenance costs will be half, and I want you to reflect that in your reserves today. And there are polite and impolite ways of having a conversation with the CEO who does that. But in the cases I came across, it was possible to find another CEO who knew this was nonsense, to have a word with the offending CEO and bring them back into line. So the profession can help in conflict resolution in this way. And the big danger of dominance risk is it always goes on too long. And we shouldn't be afraid to bring these issues to the fore early, because it's the policyholders that put their new policies on the books from the point you first think about it to the time you actually do something. Those are the policyholders that you are disadvantaging by not speaking out as soon as you think there's an issue. Indeed, another characteristic difference, I think, between dominators or dominant cultures, and they can be just as bad. Long-term capital management is a dominant culture. But one of the distinctions, one of the questions to ask is, do the customers know the risks that the company is running? And in a truly entrepreneurial organisation, they will, and in a company dominated by a dominator, then they may not. So, that's my piece on dominance risk, and there's no way. Michael Tripp and his team have achieved a superb result, and I wouldn't think you would describe Michael as at all dominant, would you? He's done it obviously with charm and encouragement and effort on the part of the whole team, and I think they've done a fabulous job. I think it's a great paper, and I'd like you now to thank the authors, the opener and the closer, for a wonderful paper. Now, it would be helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the BAJ if you could hand in any prepared notes to Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall as you leave. The next meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 p.m. on Monday, the 26th of April, when a discussion on two papers, Longevity in the 21st Century, the Cohort Effect, Insights and Explanations, is scheduled to take place. And we're now going to have a drink you're invited to continue the discussion over a drink in the council chamber. But I'm reminded for those attending Gallio and other dining clubs to make sure they leave on time. I declare the meeting closed.